Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Guidebook author Alec Binion was general manager of the Chico News and Review until September of 2013, when he became co-owner of a downtown Chico coffee house. He says that when it comes to business ownership, we are undereducated and ill-prepared. We aren't taught about assets and liabilities in school. He has written a step-by-step guide to opening a coffee house based on his experience as a small business operator, owner, and consultant. Alec has owned and operated several coffee businesses and has been a partner in a general construction business. In his book, How to Open a Coffee House in the Real World, Alec Binion offers money-saving tips for the do-it-yourselfer and ways to get investment capital. Alec Binion, welcome.
Thanks so much, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
Do you know, I was caught by your very first paragraph in your book because I thought, gosh, he's really right. So would you read the beginning of your book for us?
Absolutely. Thanks. Okay. About this guidebook. For the most part, we aren't trained to be business owners. In school, we don't learn how sales tax is collected. Very few of us learn any tradesmanship of any kind. And we aren't taught about assets and liabilities. Schools and most colleges are built to produce productive employees, and they do that well.
Now, I liked your next paragraph, Alec, because you say business ownership requires rebellion, risk, occasional rule bending, a lot of free thinking, and a general struggle against swift currents. Because that wouldn't have described me in the past.
Uh-huh.
Rebellion, risk, occasional rule bending, a lot of free thinking. Because quite a few years ago, I opened my own business, and I was, like you said, school doesn't prepare you for that.
No.
I had been a teacher or a student my whole life, but I was a fanatic about tennis.
Uh-huh.
And so I collected, well, if I ever had a tennis shop, I would order from Izod and Head, and I had all that information. And when an empty shop fell in my hands, because it really had to do that, and I thought, oh, okay, now's the time. I'm going to open a tennis shop. And it was blind luck. I wish I'd had your book. Now, your book is about opening a coffee house.
Yeah.
But your information is such that whatever, somebody opening a tennis shop could benefit by this.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think it's most of the information in the book would be very applicable to a lot of food businesses. And maybe even by extension, other types of retail businesses. But I don't know anything about tennis. But I think that, you know, I think that can work. I've certainly seen people that had a lot of knowledge and passion open something and be able to make somewhat of a living out of it. And of course, you know, retail has changed so wildly now that I would suspect that most people are doing that online now, that those types of specialty retail businesses.
So that's an advantage. A coffee house, you can't go online and order yourself a cup of coffee.
No, not yet. There might be robots in a few years, but I'm not totally sure about that.
Okay. You go on to say business ownership requires both disobedience and a healthy amount of discipline.
Yeah, I think so.
Would you pick up there in your book, Alec?
Certainly. These are two traits that tend to not go together in a personality, but good business owners learn how to be both disciplined and disobedient enough to do what has to be done to get to their goal. So I think what I'm talking about there is the kind of, I mean, you know, I've been blessed with really good mentors and I've studied the personality, and what is the commonality is this willpower, this unbeatable will to get a thing done. And that often takes a little bit of disobedience. Yeah, I've noticed. But then also people that get up in the morning and work on their own thing, even though there's no real reward for doing so at the beginning.
Well, you repeat the idea in your next paragraph.
Mm. Because most of us are totally undereducated and ill-prepared for business ownership, first-time owners fall into many of the same traps. Many will never write a business plan that includes expense and sales projections.
That was me, by the way.
Yeah.
I had no clue that that was something you should do.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Because they don't do that, they hastily borrow money. Or if they already have money, they'll spend way too much getting their shop opened. I've seen that a million times. Often they negotiate a lease badly and their landlord is collecting rent immediately. So the new business owner feels incredible pressure to open quickly and therefore pays way too much in a rushed and bumbling build-out process that becomes more expensive than it needs to be. And, you know, in my work with new business owners through my role at Naked Coffee Roasting as, you know, in my sales and consulting role, I've seen that happen so many times where there's a kind of a domino effect to not having this kind of knowledge that I learned through my own errors for sure, or watching other entrepreneurs go through their struggles. But there is a domino effect to being ill-prepared and starting with a lease, you know, just starting with a lease even.
You're having to pay outgo before there's any income.
Yeah, and commercial leases are often, you know, when you're dealing with commercial property owners, they are often willing to be very creative in how they work with you, especially now where downtowns all over the country are emptying out of retail, specialty retail businesses are emptying. So there's a lot of, there are a lot of landlords that are looking for tenants. And so that makes them just through, you know, basic supply and demand more flexible in their leases. And that's, those are conversations that we've gotten into with new coffee house owners, where they were about to step into a lease that was pretty tilted, and then we could help them be a little more aggressive in their negotiating.
My guest is Alec Binion, and he has written a guidebook, How to Open a Coffee House in the Real World. And as I was reading your book, Alec, I can safely say I'm never going to open a coffee house.
Yeah.
But as I read your book, it made me appreciate what people go through when they do. For example, I was astounded at the expense of the equipment. Mm. And that's just one item that I found was an eye-opening when I read your book.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to be as honest as possible. And the coffee, the specialty coffee business on the retail level is in a state of transformation right now, especially in California, because there is that cost of entry and the business conditions for doing business here aren't quite what they used to be like 20 years ago when I started in managing coffee houses. So
I think if people say, my gosh, I could make a cup of coffee at home for a few pennies and I'm having to pay so much more to that cup of coffee in the coffee shop. But I think if they saw the reality, and that's in the title of your book, In the Real World, if they saw the reality of it, they would, I think, have a more appreciative.
Yeah, it's and of course, you know, you can have great coffee at home, but what makes the coffee business special, and what I've always loved about it, is its ability to create community.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of a dying thing, where you have a space that is providing a place for open dialogue and kind of a relaxed lingering around where nobody's rushing you out. And it's an environment of sobriety too. I mean, I can't really think of that many venues that are like that anymore. And so I think in the era of digital communications and hyper-individualism, it is kind of a special role that coffee houses play for bringing people together that have disparate viewpoints and are from different age groups and the whole thing to really kind of knit a tribe together in a community.
I think you could also add some of us who speak other languages, Like there's a French-speaking community here, and we get together over coffee, and the coffee is totally beside the point.
Sure.
It's the coffee house that draws us, and we order and we enjoy coffee, but we more enjoy the conversation.
That's I'm glad you pointed that out because, you know, a lot of folks at open coffee houses, they're just laser focused on coffee, you know, and their thinking often doesn't go farther than an espresso machine or the amount of grams that they're putting into a brew basket or whatever. But most people's experience of a coffee house is not dependent on the coffee itself. It's good to have excellent coffee, and you should definitely do that because it's not rocket science. But what's far more important to an enduring coffee business is that atmospherical piece.
That makes people want to say, well, let's meet at whatever your
yep.
coffee house is.
Yep.
Well, I'll remind people that my guest is Alec Binion, and he has written a guidebook for people who want to open a coffee house in the real world. But so much of his information is so practical that it could apply to any business you might want to open. Maybe you're thinking about it. Maybe you've thought about it for years. And Alec's guidebook can be helpful to people opening other kinds of businesses. You go on to say in your introduction, many first-time business owners don't shop hard enough and will just purchase everything retail often with borrowed money.
Yeah.
So that's not a good way to start a business, in debt already.
Yeah. Most people are starting everything in debt already. Home ownership. I mean, you know, people are getting in debt in school. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important to avoid that as much as possible.
Well, another bit of your background and experience is helpful, too, in saving money, not going into debt. If you can do a lot of the work yourself, because I remember when I first rented the space where my tennis shop where I was going to locate, it had been, I think, a barber shop. And so I had I had to tear stuff off the wall and was doing a lot of undoing before I could start remodeling and making it into a tennis space.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, gosh, this is so long. It's just taking forever. I thought I would never get that place just torn out. But you had experience or have experience with a construction company, so you can do the work yourself.
Well, I can now, but before I couldn't. That was a business that I got into after coffee and before my new coffee role. So it was – but yeah, I'm not a great tradesman at all. But I did partner with a gentleman here in town who's excellent, Kyle Price, who taught me a lot. I can see how important that is. And, you know, a lot of this book is about a build-out process. And
now, that's a term. I had heard the term fill-in or infill, rather.
Infill, sure.
Infill.
Yeah.
And so for the tennis shop, that's what I was using the term infill.
Yeah.
So that's what you mean by build-out?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
That's just the terminology
the space.
I've been around, okay. Is build-out.
Transforming the space, whatever it had been before, into a coffee house.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think one way – I mean, I wrote this book with a focus on brevity and high value. So my hope in the construction portion of this book is that even if you know absolutely nothing about how to do anything, this could at least give you an opportunity to act as your own like general contractor and at least deal with subcontractors on your own. And that would save like, what, 20% usually in a build out.
Business guidebook author Alec Binion will be back to continue our conversation after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Small business owner, operator, and consultant Alec Binion is author of How to Open a Coffee House in the Real World. And you say any business, building a business, even a small one like a coffee house, is a large goal. If you've never opened a business before, it can feel like complex problems just keep getting in the way of solving the last batch of complex problems.
Absolutely. I had this phenomenal mentor. I've been so lucky with people that I've worked for and with. I've always sought that. I've always worked to learn. But one of the coolest things I've ever been told by an elder business person was that whatever it is you want to do, however large the goal is, all you have to know is what to do next instead of getting totally buried and overwhelmed in this massive, you know, complex set of things you have to do to achieve a goal. He told me all you have to do is know what to do next and then make sure you get that done pretty quick. And when I wrote that book, that was ringing in my ears the whole time. So it's a whole book about what to do next, you know, step by step.
Well, I caught that sentence too, and I thought, yeah, that really is good advice because otherwise you can get overwhelmed.
You know, people really, that's what gets in the way of folks' dreams is that, you know, they believe they can't because they see the bigger picture and it looks too massive. But I would hope that this little guidebook can just help people learn the skill set of even just getting over that mental condition where you can just go step by step and achieve the life you want.
And you mentioned your dream, and one of the things that I enjoy in my own life, not just fulfilling my own dreams, but if I can support somebody else in fulfilling their dream, it makes me so happy.
That's great.
And so I think if you're, say, a family member of somebody who has this idea, you know, I'd like to open a coffee shop, and instead of maybe the wife or somebody, oh, no, that would just be too risky. We can't do that. And instead saying, why, dear, if that's your dream, let's do it.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. It's hard to come by that. It's hard to come by that. Most people are very risk averse. But I can tell you that if you get my guidebook and that is your dream, there's a high likelihood that if you haven't been down that road before, that it will save you tens of thousands of dollars.
I could see that in reading your book. But I think, too, people would want to buy a copy, not just for themselves, but for family and friends, saying, look, here's what I'm going to do. And then the family and friends would jump on board and say, yeah, how can I help?
Well, I'd love that. I hope that happens.
Well, you say the complexities you face will be totally specific to your location's circumstances. And speaking of location, when I was opening my tennis shop, I got this refrain. Of course, everybody says it now, location, location, location.
Yeah.
That's the key. I was fortunate. But in reading your book, I think, oh, there's so many things to consider when you're choosing a location for a coffee house.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on that. And there's some real subtlety in what good location even means. So I would encourage folks to never do that by feel.
Uh-huh.
There's details in my book about how to not do that by feel, but with data. And
oh, I think I'll open a shop here. I like this tree that's here.
Yeah.
That's, and you say, nope, use cold logic.
Yeah, cold logic. Yeah. Most of business is cold logic. But then there's in the coffee game, there is that more spiritual piece of creating space that people really feel good in, that's elusive. That's something that comes from the heart of the business owner.
Yeah, because sometimes I don't know exactly why when we're maybe choosing a place. Well, let's have coffee at, well, where would you like to have it? And so the person opening a coffee shop needs to be listening to those kinds of things that people say, well, it's because it's near my house or because it's near my office, or we just feel welcome there.
Yeah, that feeling welcome piece comes from the spiritual posturing of the person at the top who's owning the business. And that is an esoteric thing I just said, but I'm not sure you can even teach that.
Well, that's one thing that surprised me, too, because I'd never been in business before. And when I was, I thought businesses were all businesslike. But I found that the different businesses I dealt with had personalities. There was a personality to the business.
Oh, yeah. I mean, business is just a collective of persons. Yeah.
So when somebody chooses a coffee house, there's more than just the coffee. The coffee, in fact, may not be their main reason because I don't know that much about coffee. I have a friend who's very discriminating. But, I mean, coffee is coffee pretty much to me, I hate to admit.
Yeah, I think most people are in that boat. There's certainly in the specialty coffee business, we think about it daily, quality, origin. You know, in my coffee book, I actually didn't write about coffee at all because I think that most people picking it up have their own thoughts about it, and that information is readily available. What I wanted to do,
they can look to other books for that.
So many books, and I wanted to add a book to that space that goes from how do you go from being a week by week wage earner with no real assets or pathway out of that to getting open. And I think that is something that is almost never talked about.
My guest is Alec Binion. He has written a book, How to Open a Coffee House in the Real World. And he says the value of this book is that I'll break down the process of opening your coffee house step by step from beginning to opening the doors. You can do anything in life as long as you have the ability to delay gratification and know only what you need to do next. And this is what your mentor said, Alec, you just need to know what to do next. And I latched onto that too. Yeah, that's good advice. Mm-hmm. And you say that you don't go into too much about coffee, but if I'm opening a coffee house, I have to consider, okay, what kind of things am I going to need for my coffee? I'm going to need coffee beans. And I think that's getting to be a problem, is it not? Just getting coffee beans these days?
No.
No?
No, that's not a problem. No, no, there is so much coffee in the global market that it's shocking. It's such a massive commodity.
So climate change is not really that much of a factor that you have to consider.
I'm not a climate scientist or a botanist, but I do think that there is there's going to be consequences of the climate changing in the coffee business. Absolutely, but as far as a roaster and where we source coffee at Naked Coffee, you know, our partners are doing okay. So we're, you know, we source directly from Brazil at the farm level, and we work with a group of specialty coffee importers, and you know, we're getting coffees from Ethiopia, Nicaragua, Sumatra, or Indonesia. You know, so there's coffees. It's a huge market globally. There's a lot of people drinking coffee, but that I could see that really changing as the globe shifts. It's, you know, the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. I mean, it's a tropical plant. So, and I know that from what the little I know of climate science, those boundaries are changing. So that's interesting.
But for the moment, we're okay as far as coffee beans.
Yep.
Now, you also mentioned grinding the coffee, and there are different ways to grind the coffee. So if I'm opening a coffee house, I need to buy a coffee ground? Do I need to buy my own machinery for grinding the beans?
Yeah. If you want to do it well, yep, you do. Yeah, because the coffee is just so much better freshly ground. So our company, we're a source for all that stuff. So we, you know, we deal equipment and wholesale coffee. And that, I mean, that's what I do full time is I provide equipment and coffee and consulting.
Well, now, how do I know how to grind the coffee? I mean, are there different ways, different methods of grinding coffee beans?
Yes. So, yeah, it's specialty coffee is one of those industries where everybody is always looking how to do it better and getting into these like micron level discussions. I mean, we recently made a little fun field trip to UC Davis where they have they're building a whole like research laboratory for coffee and everything that surrounds the specialty coffee business, similar to how they have a beer program for brewers. So yeah, coffee is one of those things where there's always something to learn, always. And when I wrote that book, I figured that most people that would be interested in that book already have experience in the specialty coffee business.
Yeah, you do make that point that maybe you've been working in a coffee house yourself for
– Probably, most likely. I think that's going to be the bulk of the people that are interested in that book. However, if they're not, then I am totally available to train anybody.
You do mention that in your book, that to contact you and you'll help them out. But even if I worked in a coffee house, I don't think I would have a clue at how expensive that equipment is. You talk about just these under-counter refrigerators, for example.
Uh-huh.
And I could buy about three in my own kitchen, my upright refrigerator.
Yes.
I could probably buy three of those.
Probably.
For what it costs. Why is an under-counter refrigerator for a coffee house so darn expensive?
Well, I think there's equipment, like kitchen equipment and food equipment is expensive for a number of reasons. Reliability is a big piece of that, and just it being built out of stainless steel and really solid stuff. And then there's the NSF certification piece where everything has to be NS certified. There, which probably has a whole, lobbying group at the state level. I mean, and in California, every little tiny bit of food business has a law on it. So there's often, you have to get a very certain type of gear. Restaurants and coffee houses, they fork out some serious money for equipment. And I mean, an espresso machine. We're selling espresso machines for $10,000 to $20,000.
Yeah, that's staggering.
Yeah.
That just one machine could be up to $20,000.
Yeah.
And you say that you can't – there's practically no machinery you can get for under $300.
I can't think of many things in food business that are under $300. Maybe like a spatula.
So if I wanted to save some money on a cappuccino machine and save myself thousands, maybe I want to look at a used machine. And you do give some suggestions on what might be okay to get used and what might not be a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, the sad truth is that cheap espresso machines often become really, really expensive because of service calls. And then being an espresso tech is such a niche thing that there's hardly anybody doing it. There's a company here. There's like one or two people in the whole Sacramento region. This is a region of like a million people. And so that's another business that's like desperate for people, similar to construction, is,
become a tech.
Fix some espresso machines and, there's space for that. But part of the inflation, especially in coffee gear, I think, is because so many people want to own a coffee house, that a lot of this purchasing is based on, people's retirement plans or borrowed money. So, anytime you have like a borrowed money culture around an item, its price is going to go up, just like a car or a house, right? So that's a big part of why everything's so expensive, I think, too.
Yeah. It was shocking for me, and it made me all the more appreciative for people who do open their own business, like a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the licensing and taxation and some of these business things. We don't learn this in school, Alex.
Oh, geez.
Where are you supposed to learn this?
You just learn by doing or working for a small business person, I guess. Yeah, there's just this whole – there's layers of government and, that stops a lot of people. Just the unknown stops a lot of people from kind of advancing on their goal. And, you have to get a business license in your city. Then you got to get you have to get a fictitious business name through the county. And then you got to have a seller's permit through the state. And then after that, you have to have a tax ID number from the feds. So it's like – I mean, there's stuff to do, and it's really overwhelming for folks, especially if you've never grappled with governments, and it freaks people out. So that I hope I can help. I mean, it's not that hard, But yeah, it's just a completely foreign thing if you've just been collecting a paycheck your whole life, you know?
And you haven't had to get these permits and licenses that you just mentioned.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then have to deal with withholding taxes from your staff and make sure that you don't mess that up. And
I mean, it's just. I understand a lot of businesses get into trouble there because they, oh, well, I don't have to turn in this tax money yet. I'll just borrow a little bit of this.
Yeah. Yeah. I recommend in the book that you go through a payroll service, especially if it's your first go, because they will just charge you the amount that includes all of that. And then they will hold on to that for you. And I think that's really wise to do.
So it's good to know that there are such services available.
Yes.
That can make sure you don't spend that money.
Yep.
That is not really yours, that you're just holding on to it.
Yep.
And so they will hold the money and will pay it then for you.
Yes. And then you have, you know, a fee that's usually graduated by the size of your payroll. Is generally how that goes.
Speaking of payroll, too, you have to figure out, okay, how many employees am I going to need and what are my hours? If I'm going to be open from 6 a.m. to, say, 10 p.m., that's a lot of employees that you have to hire.
Yeah. You know, we always think about staffing as a percentage. So it's a percentage of gross sales. So if you do $1,000 in a day, you know, you have $250 to spend on labor. Basically, or less, hopefully. But that's how we do that calculation.
Because I was in my tennis shop from the time I opened to the time I closed. I didn't need shifts of people coming in. But that would be necessary at a coffee shop. I would think, though, that people, when they were opening it, they do want to put in as many man hours as they can, the owner, to save some money.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
So when you had your coffee business. Mm-hmm. Were you a barista also?
Oh yeah. You know, I've had thousands of hours as a barista, working for other people and then myself. But especially when I opened, it was my first business was Empire Coffee, which is now called Great Northern Coffee. It's the art center operates it now, but it's in that restored passenger train car on Orange Street. That was my first foray into business, and I worked there quite a bit. Yep.
Now, speaking of that, because I'm sure people, if they drive by the train depot, they can't miss this car out there. It's very attractive.
It's a quirky thing.
It is quirky, and it attracted you, did it not?
Yeah, yeah. I was a puppy. I was 27, and I had just moved back to Chico, and yeah, some folks at the Art Center. They remembered me from the Naked Lounge when I was involved in opening that with its original owner, Chris Pendarvis. And they approached me to see if I wanted to open a
Alec,
little coffee house.
You
want
to open a coffee house in this little train
car?
Train car.
Yeah,
car. And you said, hey, I like that idea.
Yeah, I was. My expectations were higher for it because I was living in Sacramento. It was the kind of business that, you know, in Sacramento, it would be a completely different story. But, it was a huge learning experience. It's still open. I think I said that in my book. I wouldn't file it firmly in my failure column at all. I am really proud of that project. And I love that it's still open and I hang out there a lot. And it's ran really well by Matt Barber, who illustrated this little guidebook.
Oh, yes. I wanted to mention the illustrations in your book and give Matt credit.
Yeah, Matt's a good – I love Matt's art. Matt is a local artist who is just a really swell guy too.
Yeah, I really enjoyed his sketches of coffee cups, and this looks like a tea pot.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And little bears with honey in them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Little clever, cute images.
So you have written this guidebook for people who want to open a coffee house. That's in the guidebook. But I find it's also helpful for those of us who just patronize coffee shops to know, wow, that cup of coffee is actually a bargain.
yeah. It's thanks for saying that. That's cool that you walked away with that.
And also, if maybe it's not a coffee house I want to open, but maybe I just have this idea of some passion that I think I'd like to open a tennis shop in my case.
Definitely.
And I think this is an eye-opener for a lot of people that don't anticipate, for example, how expensive it's going to be or what are the considerations for location.
Yeah.
But then, okay, so I'm ready to open, Alec. how are people going to know I'm open?
Well, I have that's an important question that a lot of people never ask, you know?
I think just, well, I'm open now. I'm just going to open my door and people are going to flock and buy my coffee.
Yeah.
Flock
yeah,
in.
Yeah. No, I have, you know, I had a whole marketing life, of course, at the News and Review. And I, you know, I've read a ton on marketing and have competed in that space. And geez, marketing is so important.
Well, so how do I go about it? How do I let people know? Okay, I'm ready to open my doors. I'm ready for customers now.
Yeah, I mean, I have a whole chapter in there about that. And it's not about sustained marketing. It's about launch marketing. But I think for a little business like a coffee house, marketing is real ground level. It's a guerrilla game where, events, posters, understanding media enough to know where to put media dollars. That's important. And then not overspending is also really important in marketing.
Well, do you know, Alex, speaking of the Chico News and Review, one of the main reasons I grab a copy is I want to know what businesses are closing, what businesses are open.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that information. So I think if I'm opening a coffee house, I would contact the Chico News and Review and say, hey, I'm opening a coffee house and we'll be open November the 4th.
Yep. I think especially with the new media landscape of digital, you know, independent, hyper-individualistic kind of media, it's easy to forget that legacy media still has a whole big audience. So it is good for sure to write a press release, just, you know, simple things like that. But that's the kind of stuff that if you were a barista for 10 years, you're not going to think about writing a press release, you know? So that's hopefully there's some good tips in the book on marketing as well. And yeah.
Well, speaking of a press release, because for years I just was a teacher, we don't write press releases. And then as a part of my job, I was doing promotions of speakers and I realized the importance of a press release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's something that I think a first time, you know, opening a coffee house, and they would say, well, what do you mean? What's a press release?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of skill sets out there that need to be tapped for, you know, to get people to even know that you're there. And I have seen a lot of coffee houses kind of like turn into, without that marketing focus or any marketing focus at all, become kind of like a clubhouse. And not really like a community institution, you know? It's two different things.
But you say when you're having an opening that you mentioned flyers.
Yep.
And that to give people who come something to take with them when they leave.
Definitely.
What kind of information would you like them to have?
I would give
in
them.
Hand?
Yeah. I mean, if they're a brand new, if you're having a grand opening, they're brand new, right? So I'd send them away with a buy one, get one. So they can leave and then come back with a friend, or just even a little thing like a cute little magnet or a little pin or like a little sample size bag of coffee, just something to kind of stare at your name at home. But I've always been into the buy one, get one thing for coffee marketing anyway. Like, I mean, if I was slow, I would just send people out, you know, an employee out to hand out buy one, get ones so that you're always making an outward move. And also events are really great.
So if you offer something that's a little out of the ordinary, if I want to call it that, something that somebody comes to the grand opening and say, wow, you're the only one in town who offers this. I'm going to tell my friends.
Mm-hmm.
I have friends that are vegan. And they are looking, there's always the standby of almond milk and soy milk, but there's...
Well, now we've gone milk crazy, and especially coffee. Yeah, now there's every milk. So there's like oat milk is a huge hit. There's actually like a shortage of it usually because they're, you know...
Yeah, because I've been looking for oat milk myself.
Yeah, oat milk is great. There is a shortage of manufacturing for the demand that is currently there. So... I was talking to a big oat milk company just the other day because I have clients that want to buy cases of oat milk, and they're telling me that, I mean, I won't mention the company, but they're saying that they're about to build this big facility in the Sacramento area, like a factory, you know? So it's all that, which I think is great because I think it would be really good for the health of people and the planet to kind of back off of milk a little bit, cow milk.
Yeah, and a lot of times people who prefer cow milk and they try the almond or the soy and they find it's just not satisfying.
So yeah.
Here, another reason to check her. Yeah, or a coffee house,
or hemp, or a cashew, or a macadamia. I mean, they're going to make milk out of everything eventually.
And you have to know how much you're going to need because milk doesn't last forever.
Yep.
So you have to anticipate. Okay, how much milk am I going to need this week?
And cow's milk is this like phenomenal luxury as far as like in your mouth. Like it's really hard to replace. But I would guess that those folks, those Silicon Valley billionaire folks that are that did Beyond Meat and the Impossible Burger, those companies that are becoming giant companies really fast, I bet you somebody is in the back room working on milk. And if they could have a plant milk that was just like cow's milk, that would be like a game-changing product.
And it'd make everybody happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I really did enjoy your book, Alec.
Thank you.
On a lot of levels, you have a very conversational style in your writing that's fun. Mm-hmm. And you have practical information that even if we're not opening a coffee house, it makes us appreciate the fact that people have done that for us.
Sure. Thank you. That's great.
That remind people, the title of your book is How to Open a Coffee House in the Real World, and the author is Alec Benyon. Thank you, Alec.
Thank you.
After a break, humorist Eric Miller will be sharing an essay he'll be performing in Chico's Blue Room Theater later this month. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Last year was the debut of a collaboration between the North State Writers Group and the Blue Room Theater in Chico. It consisted of short fiction, poetry, and memoir by local writers, read aloud by Blue Room actors. No props were used, no costumes, no sets, so the quality of the writing and skill of the readers were front and center. This event was so successful last year, they will be performing again this year, featuring all new material. There will be one performance Friday, January 31st, and another Saturday, February 1st. Both start at 7:30. One of the local authors featured this year is humorist Eric Miller. He's written a piece he calls Hanging Out with Old Attitudes. Eric, welcome.
Welcome and Happy New Year. Appreciate being have an opportunity to share my story entitled Hanging Out with Old Attitudes. The backstory is I was visiting my dad, who's 81, lives in an assisted living home in Colorado Springs, Colorado, my hometown. And this is a true story, 99% true, a little 1% of lying. And it was an event I encountered with Dad and his friends at the assisted living center. It appears on the Etc. Guy blog also. Hanging out with old attitudes. They are kids with wrinkled skin who wear plenty of attitude. Shuttle vans park outside the main entrance to cart them to and fro, whether to doctor's appointments, grocery shopping, or to the movies. Panel doors slide open and wheelchair ramps pop out. After the cargo's load, the vans are off and about. Inside, I walk by a greeter who sits across a gym. The gym is supervised by physical and occupational therapists, young 30-somethings, coaching and pushing their clientele. Racks of 2-pound dumbbells line the walls. I observe old guys and old gals stretching elastic bands, and the therapist stretching them. I make my way upstairs to Dad's room. His TV blares at 120 decibels, the same loudness of a thunderclap. His chair perches forward like a pilot's ejection seat. "Let's go to happy hour," he said. "But it's only 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock is when things get going around here." Dad has Parkinson's disease, among other ailments. A cancer survivor, Dad is a U.S. Air Force veteran, Vietnam vet, and veteran of multiple back and neurological surgeries. His mind is sharp, albeit easily distracted. A former physician for the Air Force collegiate hockey team in the mid-1970s, Dad leans on an old hockey stick for a cane. He's ambulatory, but mostly via wheelchair. I pushed him down the hallway towards the dining area. Dad navigated the route. "Go straight, and then turn left. You'll find everyone there." Around the table sat five ladies, their hair white as snow. Canes leaned on the wall behind them. One gal sat in a wheelchair. Two had margaritas with mini umbrellas standing in their glasses. I told them I heard they were once cheerleaders. I asked if they could show me the splits. "You're a smart aleck," Agnes said, "just like your dad. That's why we like him." They asked about me, and I gave them the data dump. Then I asked about them. Midge originally hails from Massachusetts. Florence came from Louisiana. Their husbands had long ago passed away. Agnes grew up in Iowa. "Oh, Iowa," I replied. "Then I'll speak slower so you can understand." Agnes reached for her cane to wallop me. "No," she said, "that would be Bob. He's from Kansas." The ladies laughed, then discussed their ailments ranging from sore knees to faulting hearing aids to having to eat kale. Agnes bragged that she had a dinner date that evening with Frank, a retired proctologist. "He's good with his hands, dearie." Florence noticed that Bob was late for happy hour. "Where's Bob?" "Bob came 30 minutes early and left to use the bathroom. He misread his watch." Midge sipped her margarita, said she knew her booze. I asked if she heard the story about three gals who went into a bar. "Do tell," she exclaimed. Three gals walk into a bar, a blonde, brunette, and redhead. "I was once a redhead," Florence interjected. I continued. "The brunette asks for a BL. The bartender said he was unfamiliar with a BL. The brunette responded, "It's a Bud Light, duh." The ladies laughed and leaned into the table, wanting more. "Then what?" The redhead tells the bartender she wants a CL. The bartender was confused. "What's a CL? The redhead scolded him, "A Coors Light, duh." By now, my audience had bit the hook. "Tell us about the blonde. What did the blonde order?" I smiled, realizing it was time to reel them in. "Okay. So now the blonde orders a 15 from the bartender." Stumped, the bartender reviewed his notes. "What's a 15? "It's a 7 and 7, duh." The ladies howled. Agnes somersaulted backwards. Florence cartwheeled. Midge did handstands. "Bob will love this joke. We'll tell him, if we can remember it." A server arrived with a plate of snacks. We then talked about their lives, their kids, their grandkids, their great-grandkids, places they've lived and people they've loved. All appeared flustered with their current physical condition, but all appreciated the camaraderie and fellowship. They genuinely cared for one another. Bob then arrived, bumping his walker into my leg. "Sorry about that," he apologized. "No worries, sir. I'm Doc's son. What are you in for?" He grinned like a convict masking the truth. "I'm doing time for a stroke. Been here 3 years." I visited again the next day for a Hawaiian-themed luncheon. I'd sat next to Bob and asked whether the lady shared my joke. "No," he said wistfully. "They must have forgotten. Tell me." I repeated the story and Bob laughed. "We're all in our twilight years here," he said. "Hell, my sleep phone mattress has better memory than I do. But we managed to have good attitudes. You should see us on poker night. If we all had 20 bucks, we wouldn't get out of a Chinese whorehouse." Bob's timing and delivery knocked me out of my sandals. I'm fortunate my parents are still alive. Mom is in better health and lives alone, but isn't lonesome. Our friends keep us going, she told me. We have financial resources, call each other, and visit on Facebook. Retirement funds and good health aside, I observed one common theme. Attitude is priceless.
This has been Eric Miller reading from an essay that he will be reading in the Blue Room Theater in Chico on January 31st and again on Saturday, February 1st. And Eric, now we know how you come by your interest in hockey.
Yes, Dad was a team doctor for the Air Force hockey team in the mid-1970s. My brother and I grew up on skates, and I continue to play inline hockey here locally in Chico, inlines on wheels. And so I write for Hockey Player magazine, too. And it's not about, I've never won a gold medal. I've never won anything. I write about the story of a middle-aged ex-athlete has-been who gets his butt kicked every Sunday by a bunch of younger people.
We also might mention that you're also known as Et Cetera Guy. You used to write a column for the Enterprise Record. And you might also, you mentioned in passing that you have a blog. And is that called Et Cetera Guy?
Yes, it's etcgui.com. So it was kind of inspired by my wife and kids. Their first names are initials with E and T. But what really got me thinking about it was, I think it was Yul Brynner and the King of Anna and the King.
Yes, and, the King and I.
The King and I. And how he gets this young lady governess to kind of run the roost while he's busy running his country. And she pretty much runs all over him. He just walks away with his hands in the air, et cetera, this, et cetera, that. And so that kind of stuck with me.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you read your essay for us, and we'll look forward to your performance on January 31st and February 1st in the Blue Room Theater.
Thank you very much.
Eric Miller will be reading Hanging Out with Old Attitudes at the Blue Room Theater in Chico, January 31st and February 1st. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Alec Binion, author of How to Open a Coffee House in the Real World.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.